Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon. One of the big topics in the news this week has been the execution of Troy Davis in Georgia. Certainly his case brought to the forefront of the discussion about the possibility of executing innocent persons, the flawed nature of the case, sort of the selective nature of who gets executed and who doesn't. And it just felt like the right time to have a podcast in which we talk about Mormonism in conversation with the death penalty. What is it in our theology? What is it in our culture? What is it in our history and our background that has sort of shaped Mormon perceptions of the death penalty? And I've brought on three wonderful panelists who all, in their own way, have had journeys to a point where they're each against the death penalty, at least the way it's executed in, that was a little play there, at least the way it plays out in our judicial system today. So let's introduce them, and then we'll launch into hopefully a very healthy discussion about the death penalty in today's society, and especially Mormon takes and principles as they interact with it. So Heather Olson-Beal is well known to many of our listeners. This is probably fifth, sixth, seventh time we've had you on, Heather, is that right?
No.
Nah, five, maybe?
I don't know. A few times,
but she's a wonderful guest. And one of my favorite things about Heather is, in this case, she's like the first one. Whenever there's news, she writes me, this one needs to be a Mormon Matters podcast. And I probably would have come to that conclusion on my own here, but I'm just so grateful for your energy and your passion for the podcast, Heather. And so thanks for really being the early driving force in this. And would you remind everybody of who you are and your background a bit?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Heather Olson-Beal. I write a column every week for a little blog called Doves and Serpents. And I guess my contribution to this conversation would be that I was born and raised in Huntsville, Texas, which is where all of the executions in Texas take place. So it's been sort of like just a part of my whole life experience. Prisons, prisoners, the Walls Unit in Huntsville, all those kinds of things. People from church, both my parents taught classes, the prison system. We had friends from church, you know, who worked there and who had trustees that worked in their yards, all kinds of things like that. So it's definitely just been a big part of my upbringing, I guess. So it's close to home for me, literally.
If I understand at least a little bit from our pre-conversation, as a child and stuff like this was just sort of a fact of life, and it was later on that you came to see the system as broken and to take the stance that you do?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll hear more about the journey and what the turning points were for you on that. Tom Grover, we're welcoming him back for our second time. He was with us on our Brandon Davies BYU thing, one of our early podcasts. And Tom, it's great to have you back. Please reintroduce yourself to everybody.
Well, Dan, it's a treat to be here. Yeah, my name's Tom Grover, and I live in Las Vegas, Nevada. And I work for a law firm here. I'm awaiting bar results in about 10 days.
Woohoo! Hopeful good. Yeah, Did you feel good about it?
I'll tell you in 10 days. I have no idea.
Good about the bar exam.
That has one of the most difficult bar exams in the country, so we'll see how it goes.
Anything more about your background that as it relates to death penalty in particular, or just on as a generally great Mormon theologian thinker?
I am the guy who got called up at the last second and said, sure, let's do this.
We don't share secrets like that. No, Tom, another thing about Tom's background is he, for many, many years, hosted a radio program in Cache Valley, Utah, and he's great at just sizing things up, and he's very articulate, and we love having him. And it seems to me a lot, Tom, that you're very active in watching politics all the time, too.
I try to, yeah, I do. But it's a lot of fun to be with the three of you today. Hopefully we'll have a good discussion.
Well, great. I'm sure we will. And I think one of the main reasons that I know we will is our final guest is Ken Driggs. Ken is the Dream panelist. He is one of two LDS folks that we are aware of who actually do death penalty cases, represent clients in death penalty cases. I'll let him go ahead and tell more about that. But, Ken, appreciate having you on.
Glad to do it. I am in the Atlanta ward of the Atlanta Stake in Georgia. I'm a sixth-generation Mormon. I'm a career criminal defense lawyer with a kind of an extra emphasis in history. Between 1990 and 2000, I did nothing but death penalty defense work, first in Florida, then in Texas, then in Georgia. I've done habeas corpus trials and direct appeals. I probably have been involved with either as a lawyer or as a consultant about 75 death penalty cases over time, including Texas and mostly Texas. About 20 of my clients have been executed. Ironically, I've had three Mormon clients on death row and had a client hang himself on death row in Georgia who was severely mentally ill. And from 2000 to the present, I was in a public defender's office where I handled the routine criminal caseload, but also nearly all of their death penalty cases at the trial level, and have stayed up with a number of my clients who are still on death row, which has been quite informative. Anyway, so it's a subject I know, unfortunately, quite well.
And have you retired from the public defender's office?
I left the public defender's office a little over a year ago. When I left, I kept six cases with me to finish out. They were mostly clients who freaked out at the idea of changing lawyers. Four of them were murders. I'm down to one, and actually this past week I've been involved in a trial on the last one, a woman. And that will finish up Monday. So I hope to shift gears and do principally writing right now. I'm actually working on a book about fundamentalist Mormons, but I would like to do a book about death penalty and criminal justice experience perhaps next.
I hope you will. And you did write the book, No Signature Book, published it on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre of the two missionaries, right?
Evil Among Us. It was about the murder of two Mormon missionaries outside of Austin in the early 1970s. A man was convicted of that and sentenced to death. He actually turned out to be completely Looney Tunes. And his death sentence was reversed. And as a result of my book, I did not expect this or plan it when I wrote the book. The case got reopened. He was reindicted. And they were about to retry him, and he fortunately died of a heart attack before they could get him back from England to retry. That was historical research. I didn't have any direct contact with the defendant.
Right.
And that was in Texas.
Well, you know, I was surprised, actually, when I was looking into this week. There's been very few things that have actually been said on this subject in sort of the Mormon intellectual circles. There was your piece in Dialogue, Ken. Reflection on the Death Penalty, where it was a very personal essay about one of your clients. Martin Gardner, who I know, Tom, you know him from having studied law at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, right?
Yep.
Martin Gardner wrote a thing in Dialogue, which sort of analyzed especially the blood atonement connection with Mormon theology and did a historical look at how that's played out. Ken, you did a wonderful piece in Sunstone that I want to refer to a few times tonight about just the nature of clients and whatnot that you represented in, as a public defender, but also that spills over, obviously, into the death row clientele. And so other than that, do you guys know of more that's out there? I really wasn't able to find it, and we didn't really talk about it in our pre-show talks.
There is a book published by Signature, which is a history of everybody who was on death row or executed in the state of Utah. It actually has a kind of an interesting section on blood atonement.
Kay Gillespie, right, was the author of that. Yeah, The Unforgiven or something like that was the title. Just a historical look. But yeah, really taking this subject from a religious, theological angle hasn't been done that much. And so I'm excited to kind of work into that a little bit. But I thought we'd start our conversation, so anybody weigh in whenever they want. But what's your general consensus? I think this might be we're stating the obvious, but what's the general consensus that you have about Mormons in general? What is their take on capital punishment, for or against, and what reasons do they generally bring up when you were to maybe press them on furthering their position for you?
I'll talk about them in a jury context. When I was doing trial work, I sort of accept the view that Mormons tend to be socially conservative and conservative on criminal justice issues. If I'm selecting a jury and I get a Mormon in that jury panel whom I don't know, I'm trying to get them off the jury because I don't think they're going to be good for my client. But occasionally I've known Mormons who ended up on my juries, and I kept them on the juries because I knew things about them that the prosecution did not. But, I do believe that Mormons generally support the death penalty, although I think that's probably a little less so now than in the past. I actually attend a ward in Atlanta that's about half black, and I occasionally have discussions with people in my ward about it, and it's pretty clear to me that amongst my ward, I would say the majority of church members do not support the death penalty.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Can I weigh in?
Please.
I would just say, in my experience, and I've lived most of my life in different parts of Texas and in Louisiana, that people are definitely in favor of it. I mean, I think Ken raised an interesting issue in that, or question regarding how race plays into that, because most, you know, people in the wards that I've been in have been white and, you know, politically conservative. But also, you know, the whole Southern thing, I think, for me, has really played into it, too. I mean, there's really a sense of, you know, kind of, oh, we're here in Texas and, you know, we take care of justice here. And, you know, that kind of whole vigilante cowboy kind of crap. Of course, crap isn't a nice way to refer to it. But I mean, but that plays into it, too. All of that kind of, Southern kind of towing, you know, black and white. We tow the hard line and, you know, I mean, like I said, like I mentioned before we started, you know, Texas has a long history of executing people and of taking pride in it, as was evidenced, you know, in these last couple presidential debates when Rick Perry said, you know, he's not lost any sleep over the executions that he's ordered. And I think a lot of people feel like, good, you know, he's tough on crime and that's what we want, Mormons included.
Can I jump in, Dan?
Yeah, I was going to go to you next, Tom, please.
I would say there's really two, just in my observations as a layperson, two sources of general support for the death penalty in Mormonism. And one comes from within the church and our history, and the other not. Well, actually two within the church and our history. I still think there's some lingering belief about blood atonement, but nobody calls it that. And it's certainly not to the extent that people, you know, that we would have heard during the Mormon Reformation. But I remember as a child, this got brought up at church, and I remember a Sunday school teacher explicitly stating that the only way to atone for the sin of murder is death. And as a child, that heard it from an adult, it seemed to make a lot of sense. And then, of course, you know, the three most serious sins in Mormonism are you know, adultery, denying the Holy Ghost, and murder. And I think that plays into it as well. And then from without the church, you know, Mormonism over the last several decades has been infused from the outside by conservative, you know, this has been brought up already, but by conservative political culture that is a part of a reaction to the counterculture movement of the late 60s. And I think that there was a whole baggage and a whole package that came with that. And part of that package was support of the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I would say it comes from.
Well, since this issue sort of just raised its head, if you look at the statistics on the death penalty, race is overwhelmingly a factor. If you are, based on the national statistics, if you are white and you kill a black, you are not going to get a death sentence. If you are black and you kill a black, you are not going to get a death sentence. If you are black and you kill a white, you're dead meat. Overwhelmingly, you are going to get a death sentence. At one time when I was doing death penalty habeas work in Florida, I represented a mentally retarded white man who was the only man in the history of the state of Florida who had gotten a white man who had gotten death for murdering a black. He murdered a cab driver in Jacksonville. And eventually his mental retardation got his death sentence reduced to life. He's now serving. The statistics suggest that juries value white life much more than black life, that it's less the race of the perpetrator than the race of the victim. Mm-hmm. And another piece of data that's come together is that when you are selecting juries, if you get a jury of that have five or more white men on the jury, your client is extremely likely to die or to get a death sentence. White men are the most death prone of any potential combination in the jury pool. Another way this race sort of plays this out is blacks are much more likely to be opposed to the death penalty and during the jury selection process to say that they could not impose the death penalty, which means they are not eligible to serve on the jury, so they get purged from the jury pools. And that's one reason why you are much more likely to have all-white juries imposing death sentences on black defendants, because so many blacks are disqualified from the jury pool because of their discomfort over the death penalty. So race pops up all through this process.
Yeah, I want to go into things like that somewhat. As much as we can, I'd love to keep our focus on the Mormon realm, the Mormon ideas and culture and how it interplays with and stuff like that. But absolutely, race, class, all those different things, how fair it is, if it's just it's a crapshoot, if you happen to be one of the, you know, thousands each year of murders that happen that end up being, what, a few hundred at most get the death penalty. All those things are such chaotic factors. And let's get into those later on. I want to kind of focus, if we can, still a little bit more on where is it that Mormons get their general positions. We always want to say that we're living the gospel. The gospel is the most important thing in our lives. Religion is the overriding concern. And yet, is that true? How much do you guys think it comes from Mormon theology, Mormon culture, versus outside political culture, things like that? Well, you know, some of you touched on it already a little bit, but let's play with that a little bit more. What would you say is the sources for Mormon thinking?
I don't know why there would, you know, what the interplay is or interaction between political views and religious views. I'm not sure about that. But I also think we have kind of a huge emphasis on the whole justice and mercy thing. And now in this case, it seems like it's more of an emphasis on justice, but that definitely is a huge part of it. I mean, part of our whole theology is this idea that, you know, we have the natural man, and we knew when we came here to Earth that we were all going to sin and that we had to have someone pay for that. Now, I've actually had my youngest son, well, I only have one son, my youngest child actually asked me something like, well, Mom, that's weird, though. I mean, why did it have to be like that? And I'm like, I don't know. I mean, that's too big of an issue really to entertain here. And I thought with him too, I have no idea how to answer that. But that does seem like part of it. It wasn't just like it could have been done another way. We knew we were going to sin, and those sins couldn't go unpunished, basically, or accounted for. So, I mean, I think the whole idea of the atonement and the Savior plays into this too. You can't just have people doing bad things and not paying for it. That just is not in our kind of cosmic reality, I guess. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it seems like a big issue to me.
I think if you come at that from another angle, the whole idea of free agency in Mormon theology, that we are all free agents, we act and we are responsible for our actions, that we all have a great deal of power over our choices and decisions. And frankly, that was one of the things about Mormonism that has always appealed to me the most, is this personal responsibility issue. But in doing death penalty work and criminal justice work for a long time, I've kind of had to go back in the other direction as I see how much my clients come from situations and defects such as substance abuse, mental retardation, child abuse histories, brain damage, a bunch of physiological and neurological issues that basically give them less free choice over their activities than those of us who are comfortable, like healthy middle class. And so I think you really have to educate Mormons, particularly Mormon jurors, about that kind of stuff, that everybody doesn't have the same level of control over their actions. And philosophically, I'm not bothered by the idea that the rest of us have a right to be protected from those people who don't have that control. I see more of a medical model in criminal justice, and I'm not offended by the idea of quarantining some people away from society as a whole to protect the rest of us.
Ken, can I jump in with a quick question here to follow up on that? Because I read you bring this up in your article, and I know that sometimes at church when we talk about people who are born with disabilities or people who are born in difficult situations, sometimes the Sunday school response is, well, the Lord would never give us more than we could possibly handle. So the Lord must have known in the pre-earth life that the people that are born into these less than ideal situations could certainly handle it, and therefore, you know, they are ultimately accountable. What is your response to that? Because I think you would get that a lot from that comment.
I think it's a very easy thing to say if you have led a comfortable and blessed life. I just don't buy that, looking at the circumstances of many of my clients. You know, I just think that that's not true, at least not in my observation. I think we say a lot of things in church amongst ourselves who are in comfortable positions that just don't mesh with reality.
And Tom, I actually think Ken's onto something there. Besides Nephi and the whole, I'll go and I'll do, the Lord gives no command that I can't handle, is it in Scripture? Or is that version that you sort of said, is that really based in Scripture? I should have looked.
Well, it may be Mormon folklore, but I think maybe the question that begs then is, how could God be so unfair as to put those of us who have comfortable lives into our comfortable life and put those who are in impossible situations, who have not just difficult situations, but essentially the inability, as Ken is saying, to control themselves. How can we reconcile that with a just and fair God?
We're going deep early, folks.
Yeah.
I have that same question with AIDS and, you know, all kinds of curses that exist for the human condition. I really wrestle with the whole issue of where does evil come from and what is God's responsibility or role with the evil in the presence of the earth. I don't have any good answers for that. Other than that, it's something I personally really struggle with.
Right. I mean, I just read a couple hours ago before we started a newspaper article about one of the men who killed James Byrd here in Texas. And that was about 10 years ago, and where they dragged him. They tied him behind a truck and dragged him to death. And that was about an hour away from where we live now. And, you know, I read where he said, I don't regret it. I'd do it all over. I'd do it again if I had the opportunity. Which, I mean, is just stunning. I mean, when you contrast that with these other cases, and Dan, I know you said you don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of these cases, and I'm not, but it's sort of a contrast. You have someone like Troy Davis and some of these other people who, at least there's a lot of doubt regarding whether they did it or not. And then you have these other people who, where there is no doubt, and they're saying they did it, and they're glad they did it, and it's like a, you know, bravado. It's a point of pride for them. So in some ways, it's kind of hard to look at a policy like capital punishment, and I mean, how much do you weigh that in? How much, you know, how important is remorse and, you know, being contrite? I don't know. It's just, it's complicated.
I know those guys are out there. I mean, I read the news accounts too, and I have heard about them from other defense lawyers. But with one exception, I can tell you I have never encountered a client like that. I did have a client in Texas who was so evil I just had to go home and shower every time I talked to him. But
yeah.
I think that's a pretty small slice of this base.
Well, and we'll bring up some aspects of the Byrd case a little bit later in terms of the victim's family's response. But
right.
But I think, Tom, you've asked a really good theological question. Do you have any thoughts on it yourself, or are you just posing it as a counter to Ken, or is this something you've played with and come to your own feelings on?
Well, it's actually what popped out when I was reading Ken's article, the first thing, because we do, as Mormons, value the choice and accountability principle so much, as Heather and Ken have said. And it's something I've thought about before, and I don't have an answer for it, but it bothers me that I don't have one, that maybe some people have less choice and less accountability. It seems inherently unfair. So I don't have an answer, Dan, and I wish I did.
Mm-hmm.
One of the relatively recent changes in death penalty law is the United States Supreme Court finding that the execution of minors, people under the age of 18, violated the Eighth Amendment, that it was cruel and unusual punishment. And in that opinion and in the briefs, an awful lot of the driving force behind the opinion was advances in science that found that the brain was not done until really your mid-20s and maybe even to 30 with some people, that the part of the brain of a teenager that makes these kind of executive decisions about whether I do this or not do this is just not done yet at that early age. And that makes them considerably less culpable. I mean, I think that's part of this discussion as well. Mm-hmm. And it isn't just brain development that makes some people less able to make good decisions than others. There are a lot of other factors.
Well, let's bring those up. I was definitely going to push you down this road on all agency is not equal, Ken. And so besides just the natural processes of brain development, if in a healthy environment this brain might be completed, I think it's the neocortex that sort of is able to join the two hemispheres and whatnot is the piece that's last to come together in the brain. But besides that, what can interfere with that even getting completed? You talked about fetal alcohol syndrome. You talk about abuse, substance abuse. You talk about all these different ways that you get wired wrong.
Well, the thing I noticed the most in my practice, like I said, from 2000 to 2010, I was in the DeKalb County Public Defender's Office. That's the second largest county in metro Atlanta. It's about 800,000 people. And I am sure that two-thirds to three-quarters of my cases in a regular felony caseload, and this includes capital cases, had to do with drugs. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a lot of crack cocaine problems here in Atlanta. And I've come to see crack cocaine in general, but crack in particular, as just a plague that just destroys people. That's not necessarily what my clients are charged with, but that's the backstory of what's going on. I mentioned that I'm finishing up a murder trial I'm involved with now. It was a drug sale gone bad. A couple of thugs decide not to pay the drug dealer. They shoot him in the face seven times and take his cocaine. But drugs are just the backstory. Addiction is just, in my mind, a plague in this country. And I think that's harder for Mormons maybe to understand because we have the word of wisdom. I mean, it's harder for me to understand. I mean, I smoked a little pot in college, and that's sort of it, you know. And my clients come in and talk to me about their drug histories, or my investigators or my social worker pulls that stuff together. And I can't even, like, understand that stuff. As long as I've been a criminal lawyer, I just don't understand the appeal of that. But I do understand how destructive it is to decisions, to relationships, to the ability to work and function in life. I just see it as just the worst kind of plague in this country. Mm-hmm. And that happens to people with healthy, whole brains, too. They still do something idiotic that get themselves addicted.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just an opinion.
Well, good. I want to keep going. Heather, do you have anything you wanted to add?
Well, I'm just thinking, I was recently trained to be a CASA, a guardian ad litem. And so I'm just kind of dipping my feet into this experience. And I'm seeing that as well, what Ken was saying. I mean, I have a very hard time reconciling in a similar way that I do with the death penalty. This issue, you know, so we have kids who are taken away from their parents' homes because they've been abused. And in many, many, many of the cases, it's because of substance abuse. Meth is really big around here. Pot, you know, you name it. So, you know, I recently had an experience where I was listening to a parent talk. I mean, as the caseworker was going through and saying, this is what you're going to have to do before you can get your kids back. And I was listening to him and I was just thinking, the deck is stacked against him so heavily. I mean, I'm just thinking there's no way this person's going to get they're going to get their kids back. There's just no way. In terms of intelligence, I mean, just as you're listening to him talk, and Ken wrote about this in his article, they're not able to navigate the system. You know, I listen to people talk in court, and you can't understand what they're saying. They're very nervous. They obviously feel like kind of, they don't trust. There's a lot of mistrust there. And so, yeah, it's like, well, of course they shouldn't have done whatever they did to their kids. But, and I'm not excusing it, and I certainly don't want anybody to hear that and to hear what I'm saying and think that I am, but there's so many other factors. And when you consider how many of those people were in the system themselves, the foster care system themselves as children, you know, it's just a generational cyclical problem. And I find sometimes people, maybe not Mormons in particular, but I don't want to say that, but that people are not sympathetic because it's sort of like, please give me a break. Why do you do drugs? That's not good for you. We know that we shouldn't smoke, drink coffee, drink beer, do chewing tobacco. You know, it's sort of like it easy, and it is. It's very easy for me. I've never been tempted to do that. It's always been very easy for me. So in a way, I could fall into that trap too of just kind of saying, please, you know, what's wrong? It's not that hard. You just don't do it. You just say no, you know, but that's not the way it is for a lot of people.
couple different things came up there. Let me do this one first. Ken, you talk a lot about child abuse and coming from these homes and whatnot and things like that. And you mentioned something that a lot of Latter-day Saints, certainly a lot of Christians, just a lot of adult human beings who, you know, have had good lives, they'll look at this and will have a lot of sympathy for the victim of the child abuse. But as soon as that child abuse victim grows up and becomes an adult,
mm-hmm.
we're all of a sudden saying, oh, we've lost all sympathy for them as they simply act out the story that was modeled in front of them, that, you know, set the stack against them, all those things to begin with, that we were outraged at the abuse, but as soon as they become an adult and they're acting out the script of the abuser themselves, we lose all sympathy for them. I just thought that was an amazing point.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize that until I went into criminal law and, you know, started involving mental health experts to evaluate my clients and saw the pattern over and over again. Let me tell you a story. I can't tell you a lot of detail, but this was one of my Mormon clients on death row. He grew up in a family where his parents were substance abusers and fought and screamed and threw furniture and just an awful commotion and dysfunction in his household. Nobody ever beat him up, but they're always beating up on each other. And that's what he saw as a child growing up. And when he became an adult, he was almost grew up predisposed to addiction and was a drug addict and alcoholic. And the murder he was convicted of was a very brutal murder with a concrete block smashing in the head of another alcoholic while he was drunk. And that was the first case that sort of drove home to me that one form of abuse is screaming and violence in the home, not directed to you. But when children see that going on with their parents, it really messes up those kids, even if you never touch that child. Mm. And this guy was just shattered as an adult and could not function. And it came from what he saw as a kid.
Mm.
Tom, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I guess this we talk about the politics of this, and I wonder if it's so obvious that it's the family, and it looks like it is. What can we do as a society to correct that at a family level? And these are really intimate relationships, and it's very difficult to intervene in them in a meaningful way.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a lot to grapple with, I guess.
Ken makes a good point. You know, the solution is what the Mormons say, which is have strong families. But then a lot of times, But then a lot of times the political script that we are is not the script that says you devote more time and attention to drug abuse. You devote more time and attention to community training of parents, that you teach them the skills. One of the most profound pieces of something you wrote in Sunstone, Ken, it affected me back when I edited it for the magazine during those days, but I was re-impressed with it again, is just simply the ability to communicate. Heather talked about you can't understand them and stuff like that. If you haven't had stimulation around you, if you haven't talked to a lot of people, if you haven't learned how to express your feelings and stuff, it becomes very, very frustrated, and it often leads to violence because you're so frustrated that somebody can't understand you, and you do dumb things in front of the judge, and all of a sudden you're hurting yourself, and it, a lot of it just comes from purely this lack of being in a home where you're able to learn how to speak well, mm-hmm. make yourself understood. That is powerful insight into what's going on.
One of a lot of role models. I mean, we learned how to be responsible adults from our parents or from other people who fill parent roles around us. It doesn't have to be our blood parents. But we're not born knowing that stuff. Mm-hmm. We have to learn it by modeling, and that means being around good people to model after.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of my clients alive.
Yeah, and I would just say, in terms of what can we do, I mean, right now we have very, I would say, not family-friendly policies. We don't and I'm in Texas. I think we have the highest rate of uninsured. This summer in my little county, they've had like a rash of kids that have been removed from their parents' home. People are speculating that it's the heat, terrible heat, 110 degrees. People living in substandard housing, they don't have jobs, they don't have cars, they get their kids taken away, and then they have to go do parenting classes. And thanks to budget cuts, there are no parenting classes available for them to take in this county. So that involves them driving 30 to 75 miles in cars that they don't have to attend parenting classes. I mean, so it's again, you know, people have done bad things, but in terms of them kind of remediating that or trying to fix it, it's next to impossible for them to do those things that they need to do. It feels very frustrating to me as a total, you know, just a bit player. Just I'm only, you know, tangentially involved.
This is very unscientific, but just an observation of my current ward, which I've attended since, gosh, at least 1998. We have a lot of converts come through there. Many times they are single-parent mothers. And I don't think these people are joining the church because they're convinced of the theology or they suddenly get this testimony to Joseph Smith. I think a lot of them are looking for help with their families and their kids.
Yeah.
You know, they're looking for a place for their kids to play. They're looking for other place for their children to mix with other kids who are pretty good models. They are often looking for adult men who can play a positive role in the lives of their kids. I think that's the draw of the church for a great many people.
Hmm.
Very interesting. We kind of went early on this piece of all free agency is not the same. Certainly we're responsible for things, but lots of compassion, it's something we should really be willing to get into the mix of before we pronounce our, you know, second article of faith, responsible for your own sins, 100%. We ought to be able to nuance that better, and I think we've done a pretty good job of putting that piece out there today. Does anybody have anything more to say on that whole inequality of circumstances that shape people? Yeah, Ken, you made the line of, you know, these criminals, most of these people on death row were made, not necessarily simply born.
Well, I think that's true. I think with the death penalty and criminal defendants in general, you shouldn't generalize and stereotype them all because they're all different kinds of people showing up. I've certainly had some people that I thought were pretty responsible and didn't have a lot of burdens going on in their lives. But the great majority of them fall into certain kind of categories. But I do think a lot of them are made. One thing that I think is sort of related to what we've been talking about is a sense of community. As conservative as I have seen, as I feel like Utah is, and I've spent a lot of time out there, although I've never really actually lived there, I would have expected Utah to produce more death sentences and executions than they do. It kind of struck me that they have not produced as much as they have. And I think some of that is a sense of community. I think juries, when it's a stranger, the other who is appearing in front of you, it's easier to sentence them to death. But when they are a defendant who has some connection to your community, is related to somebody you know or may have gone to school with your kids or has lived there and they're inactive Mormons or something, but they passed through at some point. I think it is harder for juries to sentence to death someone they have some identification with. And I suspect that in Utah, there's much more of that kind of identification with some defendants that helps them avoid a death sentence. And they perhaps either plea or a jury doesn't sentence them to death. One thing I noticed in Florida is south. It's got a big death row, but I mean it's south, southern, and warm. We got a lot of transients in Florida. And another real predictor in Florida who's going to get death is if you're a transient, you're kind of passing through the state. You're more likely to get a death sentence for killing somebody, especially if you kill a tourist, than if you are somebody who is there and has some connection to the state. You've lived there for a while. You may obviously haven't lived successfully. But I think, I think that relates to that sense of community. Juries who see a defendant as somehow like them or somehow somebody they can identify with, they're less likely to kill them. And I think race is one of those places that race really plays in. But I think it's other factors besides race.
Very good, very good. Let's go back to, we kind of got off a little bit on the tangent. Let's talk about sources within Mormonism for the attitudes that we often find. Why don't we go ahead and just address it, Tom? You raised it very briefly a little bit about the blood atonement doctrine. Do either you or Ken or Heather too, I don't know, or do either of you want to quickly lay out what that doctrine is within Mormon church, and then we can kind of talk about its evolution and sort of the power that it's had over, you know, a lot of Mormon thinking that seems to have waned certainly lately, but let's lay it out and explain what it is first.
I'll take a stab at it, and then anybody else can fill in any holes that I miss.
Sounds good.
My understanding is this is a doctrine that did not exist in the Nauvoo period. but came about in the Mormon Reformation, I believe in the 1850s. There's a lot of heavy rhetoric. And of course, there's an ongoing debate about how literal a lot of this was meant to be. But Brigham Young introduced the idea explicitly that there are some sins that the atonement of Christ just doesn't reach. And the only way for a person to reconcile themselves to God is to have their blood spilt on the earth. And of course, that's, as you mentioned, Dan, been interpreted many ways over many years, and is certainly not a policy or a doctrine of the church now, but is, you know, the reason why Utah for many years, until recently, until 2004, had a firing squad as a method of execution. And then, you know, it's just been interpreted different ways. I mean, I guess you could look to the Book of Mormon in a lot of ways to justify some of that, even the Old Testament, but it's just an interesting doctrine that I don't think anybody would come out and say they believe in blood atonement anymore, but I think there's some residue of it that lingers in Mormon thought.
You still get a little bit of rhetoric on blood atonement with fundamentalist Mormons, which is one of the other areas that I write about. I think it tends to be sort of bombast in the sermons, although Warren Jeffs kicked all that up to another level. But a number of states in the West have, or had at least at one point, what were called election statutes, where the condemned gets to choose the manner of their death. And almost always firing squad was one of those, and in particular those tended to be states with large Mormon populations. And for a while it was sort of trendy to do constitutional challenges to those death penalty statutes as religious statutes, attributing the firing squad to local belief in blood atonement. You don't see that kind of litigation much now, but it was quite trendy for a while.
Wow.
Yeah, as I was reading, and especially Martin Gardner wrote a good piece in Dialogue that sort of took, you know, a history of blood atonement through Mormonism. And it was interesting. To me, it felt like very Old Testament. You mentioned it as possibly one of the sources, in the sense of the blood of the sacrifice on the altar, and then it talked about smoke going up to heaven, and that this literally meant something. And so blood needed to be spilled, and some of the earlier rhetoric around the Mormon Reformation in the 1850s and whatnot, when they were trying to, you know, the saints are getting too slack around here, we really need to, you know, kick up our spiritual stuff and things like that. There was lots of rhetoric about the blood needing to be on the ground to be able to cry up to God as a partial way of making up for things. What do you suppose caused it to go away or to decline, you guys?
I think one reason is, Jan Shipps has pointed out in some of her writing that 1960 was the year when there were more Mormon baptisms from converts than there were from internal births. And we've rapidly been becoming a convert church from 1960, and that an awful lot of, and I was born in 1948. I mean, I was sort of educated as a Mormon through seminary and all that, going to congregations where the overwhelming number of people around me were born and raised in the church. But as we become more of a church where people come into the church as adults and they've not gone through that religious educational process, an awful lot of things fall by the wayside. And I think blood atonement is one of those things. And also, as the church becomes more and more focused on that sort of converts and bringing converts in, they shy away from things that offend converts or potential converts. And I think blood atonement is one of those issues they would just as soon not talk about at this point.
Yeah, I'll just say, it was a few years ago that I heard about that for the first time. And I was born in the church and, you know, graduated from seminary and went to church every Sunday unless I was, you know, deathly ill. And I read about it somewhere and I was like, whoa, you know, so I said to my husband, oh my gosh, you know, have you heard of this? And what was this? And he was like, how can you never have heard of that? And I'm like, I don't know, but it either says that I never paid any attention, which I'm sure is sometimes true, probably, at least as a kid, but it says something about how little that it's been talked about. I'm 38, so I've just not heard it. I don't think it's really a part of the discourse. And so if you're not kind of a Mormon history buff, doctrinaire, I don't think it's very present.
There's another twist on blood atonement that has occurred to me too as I was preparing for this. When you have state criminal statutes, you know, that divide up how we handle homicide, I mean, somebody does something and somebody else ends up dead. There's not just one statute. The law recognizes all kinds of accidental negligence, you know, manslaughter kind of thing, reckless disregard. And, you know, we have capital murder, which some are death and some are not death, but there's this whole gradation in it. And I didn't read anything about blood atonement that seemed to recognize there was some gradation in it. You know, the stuff that I read seemed to treat everything the same.
Oh.
And I was a little, you know, that surprises me. Or I guess, as I think my way through it, it's wrong.
Yeah, when I was in middle school, there was a family in our ward, and the father was, I'll just say, very high up in the administration of TDC, the Texas Department of Corrections, and they lived on the prison grounds. And they had a trustee and that worked in their yard, in their house. We knew him. We called him by name. We called him Mr. and then his first name, and I won't say it. He obviously was not on death row. But he just was kind of, I mean, not a part of the family, but a part of their lives. And, you know, we knew him when we went over there and saw him. And I remember asking my dad once, I wonder what he did because he seems like such a nice guy. And my dad said he murdered his preacher. And I was like, no way. No, there's no way he could have done that. And my dad said, yeah, he suspected his preacher of having an affair with his wife. And just in a fit of rage, he shot him. And so I can kind of think back and remember learning that and having a huge like cognitive dissonance because it seemed like he couldn't have done such a terrible thing. And then kind of realizing, and my dad actually saying, you know, good people do bad things and sometimes really stupid things. And my dad also over the years has served in, you know, they'll have somebody that's called to be the branch president of the prison units there. And they go and they meet with the prisoners that are there. So, and I've known other people in my ward who have also had that calling. So, I mean, and they've just story after story of people who, you know, yeah, they're not necessarily bad people. They're people who did a very dumb or, you know, stupid thing, something that they definitely regret. So for me, growing up, I think there was always sort of a human face. It wasn't like, oh, those are all horrible people. It was like, oh, well, there's a lot more to those stories, to their stories than we probably, you know, are privy to.
If I had to list my 15 or 20 best friends, five of them at least would be people either on death row whom I've represented somewhere or people who I represented in a capital case and I managed to get them life and they are serving in prison and I stay up with them.
Mm.
You can look at these people in the abstract and see the evil, awful thing they've done, and I've represented some people who did some pretty awful stuff. But when you get to know them, when you start seeing them as human beings, it really changes the picture you have. When we do death penalty trials, when I do a death penalty trial, there's two parts to it. The first part is called guilt phase. That's where the jury decides whether you did what you're charged with. And if they come back guilty on something that makes you death eligible, then there's something called a punishment phase, which the same jury then decides whether you live or die. I'm the punishment phase lawyer. I learn everything I can about their lives, and I tell their biography to the jury, and I beg for their lives. Mm. So I frequently learn more about my clients' lives than they know themselves, all the horribles. And a lot of times they really do not want you telling those stories to a bunch of strangers, even if it means whether they're going to live or die. But I've felt like for years that once I've learned that information and I've succeeded in getting somebody a life sentence, or maybe they do get a death sentence and they go to death row, it's such an intimate thing to learn about them. It wasn't right to just walk away. So I've made a point to stay up with a certain number of my clients. A certain percentage of them don't want to have anything to do with it. You know, they sort of manipulate you or cut you off. But there's a group who are quite happy to have me stay in touch. And we develop a better relationship usually than we had when I was their attorney. And I will sometimes visit them in prison or on death row, send them a little money. I correspond a lot with people like that. And I do it partly for selfish reasons because I want to learn more about their prison and death row experience and about their lives. But I also genuinely like some of these people. I found them to be very decent human beings. Mm. One of the clients I liked the most was planning on murdering me at one point. He was a very severely mentally ill man, and when his psychosis was really in place, he had devised a plan to kill me, which he told another inmate about, and that inmate told the sheriff, and the sheriff told me, and said, hey, you're having no more contact visits with your client. But when he was clear, when the schizophrenia wasn't in full swing, he was one of the nicest people I've ever known. And wow. I really looked forward to time with him. And then he ended up hanging himself on death row. So he's dead now. And his family asked me to speak at his funeral, which is one of the most gratifying things I've ever done. But I tell you those stories just because you can look at the body pictures, you can read the descriptions of what they did to somebody, and that can all be true and more. But there's still, in my mind, humanity there. There's a kernel of humanity there. And when somebody is sentenced to death, it basically means society has decided you are worthless. You have no value as a human being. You should be eradicated. They get it. People think they sometimes don't get it. And every once in a while, there's a guy who's so damaged that he just doesn't. But most of my clients completely understand what that death sentence means. And they get it. And they carry that with them. So for what it's worth.
Thank you for sharing all that, both of you. One of the things that this is one of my favorite scriptures in the Book of Mormon, talks about Christ as our judge. And there's just this, I think it's just the line that simply says, "And I employ no servant there." In other words, that at the end of our life, if we're to believe the theology of Mormonism and believe this scripture, to know that a being like Christ, who has descended below all things, who's, you know, through his own suffering here in life, has learned to succor us in need, to know that there's going to be somebody who, even more than you're able to, Ken, through your in-depth look at the wholeness of this person, the integrity of their life, it's comforting for me to know that Christ would be the person, and it would be somebody who sees all of us and not just the things on the paper that say you deserve death. I don't know. Does that make any sense? Yeah, that's just one of my favorite parts of the scripture.
Where is that, Dan?
I'm Second Nephi somewhere, I feel bad that I don't know it, because I've quoted it a few times in my life, and it occurred to me spontaneously here, and I need to look it up, but maybe I'll put it on the blog.
Okay.
Hey, there are a couple more things on Blood Atonement that I think we need to mention. In the Martin Gardner piece in Dialogue, he does a good job of tracing it. And the way, and one of the interesting things that he does is he traces that Bruce R. McConkie seemed to be teaching it, and yet he, in the Utah Law Review, I guess he was invited at some point when Utah was making a change or considering the change to lethal injection and taking the firing squad off the menu. His rhetoric there was that Blood Atonement maybe works if we're in a theocracy, if we're in a, you know, if truly God's servants are in charge, then maybe they can say this would be helpful to the soul or the future eternity of this person or whatnot. But when it's a state thing, he says, we as Mormons should have nothing to do with the Blood Atonement piece, should never come in there. So if we're in a position where we're in a theocratic state again, then maybe Blood Atonement might be worth coming back into our consciousness. But he was basically saying the church should have absolutely no objection that the firing squad's taken off there because we're not in that theocracy situation. Do you guys remember that piece? Did I cover that okay?
I do remember that. And what we sort of had public relations problems is what now is when some nut job on his own decides that Blood Atonement is still the required ordinance and they're going to do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You do get that occasionally with some really disturbed individual.
Right. But the church has come out and said this isn't, you know, in this case, don't even let that be a thought. Now, the more interesting theological puzzle for me is, where would we have Latter-day Saints got the idea that an infinite atonement by an all-powerful God, you know, would never quite have enough power to overcome the sins or to provide the healing grace or whatever it would be for the shedding of innocent blood? I just wonder, where would we have picked that up? Was that just from an Old Testament sort of model? Was that from the culture? I'm just curious about if anyone has any speculation on the origins of that thinking, why we would think that Christ's atonement couldn't cover some things.
I think a lot of things we were taught in the 19th century by church leaders were sort of ruminations, you know, their own theories about stuff that never really was doctrine. The one thing that immediately comes to mind is Adam God that Brigham Young taught, and now the church has completely distanced itself from. But I just think there was more of a culture of religious speculation and discussion in the 19th century church than there is now.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're sort of closed to speculating about things like that. So I think Blood Atonement may have come out of that culture.
Mm. Any thoughts on that, Tom?
Ken's definitely right that there was a lot more latitude for leaders and even laypersons to speculate about church doctrine in the 19th century. And a lot of that probably has to come out of the fact that the church was still new at the time and the doctrinal boundaries weren't exactly thought out. Consistencies, as much as you can be consistent in a religion, weren't thought out at that time. And, of course, one of the great things about the early Restoration was that exploration. There were a lot of great things that came out of that exploration that we still cherish today. The idea that we have two heavenly parents is an idea that kind of came out of this exploration and speculation. So we talk about Blood Atonement and Adam God and kind of say, well, that's speculation that we no longer like. But, you know, there were some good things that came out of that, too. And I think Ken's exactly right. That's probably where it came from.
Cool. You know, one thing occurred to me too. Ken, you mentioned Jan Ships talking about in the 60s when more converts, mm-hmm. you know, more converts baptisms than regular baptisms and stuff like that. It dawned on me too, there's been the good stuff that sort of traced how in the 20th century the church has become much more in its theology, much more like Protestant theology.
Oh, you know, yeah.
And so the grace orientation and whatnot, I think just... You know, we've become to embrace that more and more and more, and I think this idea of an atonement that can only work partially or can only go so far, only cover some things, might have naturally just gone away as we've had that influence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I grew up, again, this dates me age-wise, but I grew up in a Mormonism that didn't have hell. I don't remember there being a hell. I remember just the three kingdoms of glory and the outer darkness. And now I sense this... Suddenly hell is sort of creeping in. And my personal belief is that a lot of those kinds of doctrinal modifications are coming in from converts who bring it from their own religious traditions, and the church is just kind of absorbing that.
Yeah. One of the things that I love about this podcast and or just the type of discussions that we're having here and that I get involved with lots of things is, you know, we're learning to think for ourselves. We're learning to sort the culture from the theology, from the more pure revelation. We're learning to do it. I think this is an important thing in life to do, to say, oh, that is speculation, and to still be able to handle an affirming stance towards these people as prophets, etc., who are still at some points just still speculating or, you know, offering their own opinion and stuff like that. So I think this is the maturing process of a human being as they become more deeply religious and you know, moving on in their spirituality is to be able to take a look at those things. So I'm glad for these little moments where we discuss stuff like that.
This is a little bit of a tangent, but I like the 9th article of faith, which talks about we believe that God has revealed, is now presently revealing, and will yet reveal many things. But the heavens are not closed. We're still learning a lot of stuff. And I think that man's understanding of God and the universe and our eternal existence is still very, very primitive. And we're trying to evaluate and understand these things from a very primitive perspective. And that on the other side of the veil or at some point in the future, we may have a very different take on a lot of this. And that's the will reveal many things of the future that the 9th article of faith refers to. And I've also read several places that John Taylor taught, not as a doctrine, you know, he wasn't saying, thus saith the Lord, but it was his belief that we each judged ourselves, that when judgment came, we knew everything that we had done, and we knew the circumstances of it, and we would be at a point where our minds and spirits would be cleared to where we could pass judgment on the content of our lives that we're not able to do while we're here in this mortal sphere. And I personally subscribe to that as well. And I think that factors into this whole discussion of people who do horrendous things to other people.
Mm. Yeah, very interesting. And there is lots of scriptures that say that the hell that you're in is the feeling, the overwhelming of an awareness of one's own falling short. My soul was racked with eternal torment. You know, this is Alma for his 3 days and nights when he's caught up and and there's other places. I wish that the mountains would fall down upon me and do these things. We're perfectly capable of recognizing our own evil, our own ability to fall short. And in some ways, I think you're right, Ken. There's more than just a John Taylor speculation here or there. There is that sensibility of you know, we are condemning of ourselves, but then luckily we have the grace element that comes in there, and a God that knows us fully, and a God who sees our divinity and our potential, even in the face of all these different things, and helps present that picture to us. And any steps that we take towards God or towards that better image of us is going to be 100% rushed towards. Anyway, I just love all that stuff. But here's what I want to do, guys. We have about a half hour left. I don't want to go much longer than that. One of the biggest pieces for me as I read these death penalty stories that come out are the different reactions of family members to the killer. Some are able to forgive. Others are unable to forgive. Some say, I must have this person put to death in order for me to begin to have closure, in order for it to signal that the life of my loved one was worth something. I absolutely need this guy to die. And I think that's a place where religion and certain, to me, higher, lower, I always hesitate to do stuff like that. There's different pieces of religion that can kind of coalesce and speak well to that issue. So we can talk about it in the political arena where, you know, I know that's one of the arguments that people need closure, but I'm more interested in the spiritual realm. If we're a victim, or if a family member of ours is a victim, what's best for us? So what are your experiences, Ken? Maybe we'll just go with you first. Of families of victims who do better or worse from you, and how does it play in with the death penalty?
I have been close to cases where there were death penalty cases where the victim's family has told the prosecutor, no, not in my child's name, and the prosecutor's relented and pled the case to life. I know that's not an uncommon reaction. The term you hear all the time is closure, that people are going to get closure when this execution happens. And I think that's a myth. I don't think people get closure. I think the hurt is still there. They still have a hole in their heart. And if anything, the hole may get bigger, because when the person's executed, they don't feel any better, and they were told or believed that they were going to feel better. To me, it is the more Christian thing to be able to overcome that and go on with your life. Doesn't mean that you don't remember the victim, the person you loved. I just think if you give in to the pain and the anger, you're not going to heal. That's me talking. That's not doctrine, but that's me talking. And I've had some discussions with victims' families. When I have trials or hearings and the victims' families show up, I really try to go and introduce myself to those folks and tell them the fact that I'm here arguing for the life of this guy doesn't mean that I don't appreciate the awful thing that happened to your child or your family member. Sometimes I get a very frigid response, and sometimes I get a handshake and a real thank you.
Heather, you were impressed, I know, with James Byrd's family. Do you want to share that? And this is a case where they said, not in our name, please.
Got
don't.
It.
Yeah. Don't do it. But the state didn't relent, you know, obviously in that case. Right. But tell me, you know, what struck you and tell the circumstances of that.
Well, from what I read, I believe that James Byrd's wife has died between when he was killed and now. I could be wrong about that, but what I read was his daughter and someone from the press had gone to ask them whether they were going to come and brought up this whole idea of, you know, do you want to witness it? Do you feel like you need closure? And she said, we do not, and said, we're not going to see it. We don't feel like we need closure. We have forgiven them, and we don't feel like anything's going to be gained from it. And she was speaking in behalf of the rest of the family, and said, we attribute kind of our stance right now to what we learned from our parents, and it was their, you know, kind of belief in God and redemption And I just thought that was so powerful. I have zero experience with this, luckily, so I'm reluctant to judge someone who reacts in the other way. I would never look at someone, you know, just like I said, I have no experience, and say you shouldn't want that, or you shouldn't have gone to watch that execution or whatever. But I admire people like James Byrd's family who, and I marvel at them actually for being able to do that, because I can only imagine how painful that would be. But somehow it seems like they were in a good place despite, you know, so much, you know, inexplicable grief, probably, to be able to say that won't help us, you know, and we're moving forward. And maybe that was a way for them to honor his life.
I share Heather's thoughts that I'm reluctant to judge the reaction of anybody who's gone through such a horrific loss, but again, in admiration of those who can find it in themselves to forgive. I cannot think of a greater act of forgiveness one could show in this life than to forgive someone who has taken the life of someone that you, one of the people that you love the most in this life. It's beyond my comprehension to even understand how that forgiveness can exist, but it's amazing that it does.
Mm-hmm. Can I just interject, Dan?
Absolutely.
I would say that for me also, becoming a parent has made, or I guess just has changed my view on this whole issue, because I kind of feel like, wow, I have three kids. The oldest is almost 15. God forbid, you know, one of them were to ever do something really horrible like that. I can't imagine how I would feel. But I also can't imagine, you know, hating them and thinking that they were less than human and that they deserved to die for that. I mean, so, you know, and I remember reading about the Columbine killers and the parents of those kids. And just my heart just went out to them, because it seemed like, oh, I mean, those people are victims. You know, the parents of the kids who did those horrible things, those parents are terrible victims too. And some of them were treated really badly by the community, and they were blamed. And anyway, so to me, that's part of also why I was very saddened and continue to be when I hear Rick Perry talking about how it doesn't bother him. Because I think even if you come down on the side and say, like I said, this person that killed James Byrd and said he would do it again, I mean, that really pushes me just about to the brink. Even if you decide that is what the state needs to do, the person deserves it, we have incontrovertible evidence, this is what we're going to do, there still is just sanctity of life, and it's still something that should give us all pause. I felt the same way when people were hooting and hollering about Osama bin Laden. I mean, obviously he was a horrible person, and I'm not saying whether he should have lived or died, but it doesn't seem celebration worthy. And that was another thing that bothered me when I was growing up in Huntsville, was to see pictures in the newspaper after there had been an execution, and to know that there had been people, protesters there, and also people there that looked like they were tailgating at a football game. It was fun for them. It was like blood sport, sort of gladiator-esque. Beer kegs, loud music, partying, kind of celebrating a death. And that seems like, even if it was a terrible person, it's sad. It's so much loss of potential. It's sort of symbolic to me of a lot of human misery and pain. And so it still seems like it should be quiet and silent contemplation, I guess, rather than, you know, partying, basically.
In Huntsville, it was the drunken frat boys who'd be down there in the corner. I've seen a lot of those.
Yeah.
You know, that's, if anything else, that's just evidence of how immature people are at a certain age. That's how I received that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think having been involved with this issue for a long time, let me just set out a couple of things that I think are in the minds of people who support the death penalty. One, I mean, I can understand that certain acts represent to people, you have forfeited your life, your right to live among us, that you have forfeited your right to life because you've done something awful. And believe me, some of these crimes are just horrendous. There is a resentment about the idea of paying for the incarceration of this person for the rest of their life, and they're thinking that it's going to be, you know, less expensive to execute them. The way the numbers work out, that's not necessarily true, but that's in people's minds. I know the victims' families frequently think they are going to get some sort of closure, and that seeking a death sentence is sort of their way of affirming the value they place on the life of the person who was murdered. So, I mean, there's also the the concept of if the state doesn't do this, somehow we're going to open it up to vigilante justice, and people will go out on their own and try to exact retribution. I don't agree with those points of view, but I understand that people have them, and I don't consider people who have those views to be monsters. God forbid I should ever be in that situation myself. I think it's very hard to pass judgment on somebody living through that kind of nightmare in their lives. One of the things that's come out is frequently the parents of murdered children divorce, that the murder of that child, no matter how strong their marriage may be, it breaks marriage up because people handle grief in different ways. I mean, it's just a wrenching experience for people to go through. So I'm not at a point in my life where I'm ready to pass judgment on people that have those feelings.
I appreciate all of you guys being very careful about that whole idea of not knowing how we would react, and so not passing judgment on other people who feel these needs for closure. I'm just wondering, though, at least it's occurred to me through the years, if the death penalty were taken off the table, if we were like some other countries that said, no matter how horrendous the crime, we as a state will not put you to death. We'll certainly quarantine you. The way Ken says, you've lost your right to intermix in our society. You've lost your right to a comfortable life, to freedom and certain things. We'll do that, but we'll take the death penalty off the table. I have my own conclusion that I think it would move you towards, gee, I've got to get myself right with this. Somehow or other, I'm letting this eat me alive when there is absolutely nothing I can do about it in terms of that person dying for this murder. I've got to get on with my healing. It seems like that might happen faster for people rather than the 8 years is probably about a minimal stay on death penalty for anyone who's fighting it, up to 17, 18, 20 years on death row and extending that out. Does that make sense to you, that if it was just off the table, more people might move in that direction?
Absolutely, I believe that, because you're going to get contacted by the DAs and the Attorney General if you're the family member contact. You're going to read about it in the paper. The average time in the United States between sentence and execution is 8 to 10 years, although a client of mine in Florida is coming up on an execution date 30 years after the crime. It's a presence in your life for a long time, and I can't see it being anything but a destructive presence. So I would hope that would help people heal if it just wasn't rubbed in their faces all the time.
The other two of you agree with that basic take?
I think so.
Okay. The second thing is this idea that without this person's death, my child, my brother, my sister, my mother, my father, their life isn't being properly honored unless this person were to die, and I wish they would even die, you know, in as brutal and frightful way as my person did. That idea that without that happening, that life was devalued, I'm wondering if we should concentrate more in our society on saying, well, take a look at that person's life of yours, and instead of focusing on the death of somebody else paying for that, how about honoring that life through the way John Walsh honors his child life with America's Most Wanted, the way that mothers against drunk driving, you know, take on a cause to prevent grief and other things, to have these Amber Alert laws and these, you know, different things. Parents or somebody who says, my child was into the arts or something, and so I'm going to take meaning from their life and their love of dance or whatever, and I'm going to create scholarships or do things to have this life be meaningful in these other ways. I'm just wondering if I don't hear much of that rhetoric out there. It doesn't seem like it's out there. It seems like we're all distracted from these potential other areas of things by this desire for death, you know, as justice being served. And, you know, we can honor somebody's life in so many different ways. And these are the ways that would lead to healing and closing. Like Ken says, you're never going to not have that hole in your life. But I think a new energy can kind of come in and fill and make things better. So that's just another thought for me, that if it was just taken off the table, maybe more of us could work in that direction.
I suspect what you've described happens more often than we know. Yeah. I think the media gets, it's better news stories when you talk about conflict and battling it out in the courts and leading up to an execution. That is more likely to get you headlines than the people who quietly go about doing something constructive in the name of the victim. So I think that happens more than we realize.
I wouldn't doubt that it does. And, you know, just the whole idea of, I'm just always impressed with the Holocaust victims who were saying, you know, at a certain point, I'm just not going to give Hitler the power over my mind, my heart. I'm just going to quit thinking about him. I'm going to move forward in my life. And I don't know, that's just a wonderful way to do it. And I know public policy and the intermix of these sort of, to me, spiritual ideas of healing and atonement and all those things, to me, they're not super clear to draw those direct lines, but I do think somehow or other the death penalty being an option can harm at least some progress in those areas if you deem what I've talked about as progress. So. Mm-hmm. Anyway, well, I wanna have a chance here before we end, you guys, for each of you to share, if you want, what it was, a little bit about your journeys to where you are on the death penalty, where you began, what started to, you know, become the bigger pieces that sent you in the direction that you are. Just sort of let's add the human story to these more abstract, you know, different things that are out there. So. Tom, do you want to start? It seems like we haven't had you talk very much today, so I'd love to have, you know, your take on, you know, what arguments impress you the most, or what spiritual principles have guided you to where you're at.
Well, I just think overall the thing that has been most convincing to me, I don't have really a compelling story or a change in position or an epiphany, but the thing that's always been forefront of my mind is a threshold issue that we have a justice system that's great, and I'm grateful for it. I think there are a lot of fantastic things about it, but there are also a lot of flaws with it. And one of those flaws, obviously, is its fallibility. And even if we took the position that people deserved to lose their right to be among us, I think that's how you phrased it, Dan, we have a system that is incapable of accurately sorting that out, and as a threshold matter, I think that's what's most convincing to me. And then we also get into the human element that both Ken and Heather and you, Dan, have brought up tonight. That and Ken made the great observation about situation in Utah where people that relate to another person and can find that common ground are much less likely to step in and sentence them to death. And so I think it's inconsistent with just basic human values. I know that sounds really general, but that's what I believe, and it's something that really doesn't benefit our society. That's where I'm at.
So somewhat of a pragmatic reasons more
right.
than yeah. Okay, great. I appreciate that, and feel free to jump in more again later. Heather, would you mind sharing a little bit more about your journey?
Sure. So I think I shared at the beginning, or maybe you did, that I would say maybe 10 years or so ago, I would have said that I was in favor of it. You know, this is what we do. This is, you know, we go through these appeals, and if people commit horrible crimes, they don't deserve, you know, that argument. They forfeited their right to live. I guess if I could kind of trace when I started to change, it would probably be when I started working on my PhD. I have a PhD in curriculum and instruction. And it probably was just reading and learning more about human diversity, I guess, and learning about educational policies and what happens to kids and families in schools, how poverty plays into that, race, the school-to-prison pipeline. I mean, looking at schools and kind of saying, wow, you know, we're tending more towards treating kids like little criminals, and we're getting to a place, I think, culturally in our schools where we expect kids to be bad and to act like little thugs, and then maybe they deliver on that for us. And my own daughter just started middle school about a month ago, and she commented to me that she doesn't like it because she said, I feel like in elementary school they expected us to be good, and now that we're in middle school they expect us to be bad. So for me, it was looking at all those kinds of things in terms of our educational system and looking and saying, wow, who does our system privilege and who does it marginalize? And how does that feed into, you know, the criminal justice system that made me kind of doubt whether we should be doing that? And then all the issues that Tom raised about not being able to be sure. You know, people get executed on the basis of, you know, eyewitness testimony from 20 years ago. And that to me just seems really unconscionable. And then I would just say, okay, so I'm 38, so somebody who is older might look at me and say, you know, you're just a young kid, you know, you don't know anything, and I'm sure I'm deserving of that, of being described in that way. But if I look back 20 years, I think, wow, I sort of, older I get, I think I know less. But it makes me much slower to judge other people for what they do, for the good things they do and the good things and that they fail to do and bad things, just because I feel like life is messy and it's hard. And I kind of want people to give me the benefit of the doubt. And so it's just made me, it softens some of my edges, I think, to just go through some things in life that are hard and to just be made aware that life is hard. And for many people, it's way harder than it is for me, just by virtue of my DNA and my parents. And I kind of have led a totally charmed life that I don't deserve necessarily. It's just been sort of gifted to me. And other people don't have those kinds of privileges and opportunities. So it makes their lives very different than mine.
Excellent. Thank you. Ken, would you share however much you want?
I would say that I grew up sort of in a middle liberal kind of family set of attitudes, which I absorbed. And I was generally opposed to the death penalty growing up, but didn't have real strong feelings about it until I started defending people and got to know them. In some instances, got to know them quite well and began to see them as real human beings. I have witnessed some of my clients be executed, some of whom were quite damaged and hard to like, others who were people that I liked. I tell my clients, when the time comes, if you want somebody there to witness who takes no pleasure in your death, but somebody who sees your value as a human being, I'll be there. And some of them have been quite grateful for that. So it was humanizing them. I mean, there were a bunch of other reasons. I do think it's unfair the way we parcel it out. I think race is a huge problem. Geography is a huge problem. In Georgia and Florida, where you committed the murder had as much to do with whether you got death as almost any other factor, just because of local attitudes and the local district attorney. But mostly I think the reason is the people that I came to find that people have value as human beings. We're all capable of doing something awful in the wrong situation. And to echo some comments you all have already mentioned, working with my clients has made me realize how much the Lord blessed me. Every day, even though both my parents are dead, they reach out from the grave and enrich my life. And many of my clients never had that. So it's a combination of those things. But mostly it's, I found there are people that I like. I know that's hard for some folks to accept, but they're people that I like. I'd go out and go to a ball game with.
As we close this podcast, I'm just struck again with the importance of this topic. It's something that we always need to tread lightly on. We're talking about human beings. We're talking about us as judges. We're talking about us and our responsibilities to be compassionate, that we know that the wholeness of our soul, you know, is what we're trying to work on. We're trying to grow into Christ-like beings. And I think it's humbling to have these moments like the Troy Davis situation that highlights, again, the arbitrariness, the stubbornness, the different things that go on to make something like this. But it's just, again, I'm glad for these opportunities that it forces us to really go deep within ourselves and say, who are we? What would be my hopes and dreams? How do I balance justice and mercy? How do I try to look with open eyes as well as an ear towards, you know, fundamental right and wrong? Anyway, I'm just grateful for this discussion. I have no clue if we certainly didn't cover deterrence. We didn't cover the costs of incarceration. None of the external things. I was glad that we spent as much time as we did on stuff that relates to religion and our souls and our growths and telling stories. So hopefully those who wanted to talk about those other aspects will jump in on the Mormon Matters blog, as we'll post this on Tuesday the 27th. And Ken, thank you so much for coming on. We have drawn on you in many, many ways, and we'll certainly post links to a couple of your articles and any that you want to send us that I'm not aware of too. Know that I'm happy to post those on the blog. So thank you very much. Heather, thank you for writing me the second the Troy Davis thing was making news and saying, we got to wrestle with this. I really appreciate that.
Hey, Dan, will you let me tell one thing quick?
If I promise. Oh, please.
I just want to tell, this is an example of kind of the best that Mormonism has to offer, I think. That's from my home ward there in Huntsville. My sister has told me that she's in the Young Women's Presidency, that the young women in her ward have gone twice, I believe, to a place called the Hospitality House, which is the place where the families of death row victims are invited to come spend the last day of their loved one's life. And the young women in the ward have gone there. They've taken a meal, and they've gone and sung songs to the people that are there. I mean, the people spend the day there, and they're able to go visit the person, but then they're just kind of there, and I'm imagining it's a very long day. But my sister said a lot of the girls went, and that it was a life-altering experience for them. She said that more than one girl said, you know, I will never forget coming here and seeing these people and seeing that they are real people and nice people. You know, again, like we're talking about, you know, the worth of souls. But when my sister told me about that, I thought, you know, that's an example of truly of pure religion, undefiled before God. And what a great opportunity for those teenage girls to go and interact with people who are, you know, caught in the web, not by their own choosing, of our justice system, and to have mercy and to show love for them. So I just wanted to share that because I thought it was a really good example of compassion.
Awesome. Thank you. More stories like that, please.
If you want me to tell you that story from my article and dialogue about that guy's family, do you got time for that?
Sure.
I had one of my clients who was executed in Texas. He was in the second round of habeas. We knew, all of the lawyers who worked on it knew we weren't going to be able to stop it. To be perfectly honest, I never thought there was much doubt that he'd done it. He'd been on death row for about 8 years. And we got it very late. I mean, I was assigned the case 10 days before his execution date and went down to death row to meet him one time and talked to his mother all the time, who was this very sweet, very nice, very distressed religious woman. And she would call me a couple of times a day. And, you know, I didn't really have any new news for her, but she just kept telling me that it settled her down to hear my voice. And she said, because you'll tell me it's going to be all right. And I was making a point to not tell her that. And at the end, she was calling me at like 5:30 and 6 in the morning because she couldn't sleep. And I wasn't sleeping a whole lot then as it is. And the night of his execution, I was in Austin in my office because we had something pending in the U.S. Supreme Court. I had to be there to deal with that. There was not time for me to get to Huntsville to be with him at the execution. And the Supreme Court has a death penalty clerk, a capital appeals clerk, who whenever there's an execution anywhere in the United States, she's in the Supreme Court all night, you know, until it's carried out. And she called me about, 9:30, I guess, to tell me that the Supreme Court had denied our cert petition 8-1. I got one vote. And then she asked me, will you be filing anything else? And it was a question I wasn't really prepared for, because what that translates to in legalese is, are you going to let your client die? Have you given up? And I told her no. We'd already discussed it. We didn't think we had any legal issues at all. And that hit me. And then I called the prison, and I had to go through a series of transfers till I finally got to my client, who's in a holding cell off the execution chamber. And he sort of panicked at first, you know, what else can we file? What else can we file? And I told him, you know, we've had this discussion. This is it. The Supreme Court's turned us down. And then he wanted me to connect up with his mother and his family, who was in a motel there in Huntsville, to be with him and to witness it. And he didn't want me off the phone. He wanted me on the line while he was saying goodbye to his mother first and then his sister and his others. And I'm in the background while this conversation takes place, and he gets about two words out of his mouth to his mother to basically tell her that we'd lost the appeal and the execution was going to go through. And she dropped the phone, and she just started wailing and shrieking, and everybody else in the room knew what that meant, and the whole room just sort of exploded with this anguish. And I'm, you know, sitting here listening to this, and talked to them for about 45 minutes, basically going from person to person on the phone, making his goodbyes. And I felt like such a voyeur. It was just such an intimate thing that I just felt like I had no business being part of, and I was crying. And then hung up, and there wasn't time for me to go to Huntsville. This is when they were executing at midnight, and I couldn't get down there. I left my office about 11:30 and laid in my bed awake until about 3 until I finally went to sleep. The next morning, his mother called me and asked me to speak at his funeral, which I did. And when I spoke at his funeral, I was sitting next to his son, who was 8. His girlfriend was pregnant with this child when he got convicted and sentenced. And the whole thing was just really emotional. And it really drove home to me, the bad guys got mamas too. Their family, that ripple of suffering circles out. It isn't just the victim's family who was brutalized by a murder. A whole bunch of lives got ruined by that kid's acts. And like I said, I don't have any doubt that he did it. But it was good for me and really traumatic for me. But the bad guys got mamas too. Their families bleed too.
Wow.
Thank you. And thanks for being on the call, Ken. It's really helpful, and Heather, too. Tom, thank you. I hope you enjoyed yourself. We enjoyed your perspectives and asking the hard questions and the good things like that.
Thanks, Dan. It was a lot of fun. It was great to be with all of you.
Good. Well, we'll have you back when we get to other things. And hey, well, thanks, everybody. Please keep your support for Mormon Matters Podcast coming. It really makes a big difference to get those $5 and $10 and $20 subscriptions each month or just donations. So I thank you very much for doing that. And let me just wish our panelists good night. Thank you so much for being on.
Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.